I'm speaking with conductor Andrew Kohler about the Kalamazoo Philharmonia's program for Sunday at 4 o'clock. It will take place at Kalamazoo College in the Light Fine Arts Building. Music begins at 4, as I mentioned, and there's it's a ticketed event. Tickets available at the door. You can find out more online. The Kalamazoo Philharmonia has a website and a Facebook page as well. Which piece, Lou Harrison, Roberto Sierra, or Florence Price, will you be beginning this program with?
We actually begin with the Harrison. That is the first piece. To try and put it in context, Lou Harrison was sort of a figure who, I think he was born in 1917 and died in 2003. So he really lived through most of those incredible upheavals in style throughout the 20th century. And he started his career as a composer studying with Henry Cowell, who's the great maverick of early American music, early 20th century American music. And from Cowell, he got a sense that there was a wider world out there of different ideas and different sounds. Then, interestingly, he studied for a time with Schoenberg, and he started writing serial 12-tone music, that is to say, very contrapuntally discordant music, which was certainly something that a lot of composers were interested in exploring, most particularly after World War II. Well,
that's what you'd do if you studied with Arnold Schoenberg.
Yeah, although Schoenberg was remarkably undoctrinaire, believe it or not, with his students. He didn't love it, but he would let his students explore other things. And in fact, even near the end of his life, Schoenberg sometimes went back to sort of things that touched on tonality once in a while. So he softened a little bit in his older years. But at any rate, so these are totally juxtaposed ideas. Later, like many composers before and after him, he discovered the sound of the Javanese gavelan and fell in love with it, and was interested generally in instruments and especially timbre, even more than particularly the scales or the compositional building blocks of other musics, say from Asia. But it was a timbre that really attracted him most particularly. He also got interested in just intonation as opposed to equal temperament. I know these are all very technical terms, but you know, if you think of the keyboard taking a scale and sort of dividing it very equally between each note, in fact, the natural occurring harmonics, overtones, notes tend to be a little bit more rugged and jagged and not quite so evenly placed. And he was interested in that kind of a tuning, which might sound to our modern ears as slightly out of tune. Mm-hmm. And even microtones, that is to say, the space between those even spaces, finding. Yeah, so he experimented with all this stuff. So, in a time when many composers felt very much committed to one particular track and sort of spent a lot of their efforts decrying every other one and saying, no, those are fools. Anyone who would compose in X manner and not my Y manner is just a fool.
Right. This is the future.
Exactly. This is the only path forward. Lou Harrison was just someone who embraced everything, embraced the world, embraced all these different styles, loved the people around him. He obviously took so much from his friends and his mentors, was again, expressed admiration for the person who would become his lifelong partner, Bill Kollwig, in the 60s, at a time when a lot of times those kinds of attractions were left unspoken, were more safely left unspoken, perhaps. Loved nature, just loved being in the West Coast, all of it. So, and somehow, remarkably, I feel like this capacious sense of embrace all comes together in his Third Symphony. It sounds to me sort of like nothing and everything at once, is a phrase I've been using a lot in talking about it. And it's got some very muscular bits, you know, where you've got great big blazing brass. It's got incredibly intimate moments. It's got moments of static stillness that just repeat. It's also got, again, speaking of that love of Javanese gamelan, a very unusual percussion section that uses in it a tack piano. So that is a piano that's been modified to have tacks on the hammer, so it has a more metallic sound. Think of a sort of old Western saloon honky tonk piano, that kind of sound. He's got that in there, and that in combination with a celesta, which is another kind of toy piano, and some mallet instruments, create something like a gamelan like sound.
Orchestra, yeah. Yeah. So you take the hall's normal piano and modify it for this?
We have taken it. We've not taken the sort of the premier 9-foot Steinway that we have in that space and stuck tacks in the hammers, because I'm pretty sure my piano colleagues would faint if I suggested something like that. So instead, we've taken an upright piano from one of our practice rooms, which was in significant enough disrepair that we felt comfortable that it could be modified in this way. But yes, we will have a tack piano on stage. We have done the work to get it modified. So it'll be there. And again, this piece written in the early 80s, but with certain parts of it that came with sketches that started as early as 1937, in many senses summarizes, I think, his whole career and his ability to synthesize very different kinds of styles, as well as his love for people and mentors. So he does an interesting thing. The second movement, which is usually the dance, has three dances in it. So he gives us a suite of three different movements. The first of these is called a reel in honor of Henry Cowell, who was, as I mentioned, his first teacher.
Very Irish, too.
Yes, and it is an amazingly catchy tune, and it's even got, as the composer himself put it, quote, the spoons clattering and everything. He actually asks for spoons to be played in the percussion section during this moment. So you'll hear a little bit of the very unique approach to sound that he's got. This is a very interesting pentatonic tune, but it's densely harmonized, and it's a real toe tapper, and I think it's a great introduction to his sort of one of a kind sound.
Andrew, with the track that I have here, it looks like it's all in one track. So unless you can recommend how many minutes into this track that this reel might appear, we may land in a place that you're not expecting. But if you put in the headphones, we can maybe hear and talk about where we're at and how much further we have to go to reach a part that
sure.
You're interested in.
Let's aim for about 8 minutes and see where that leaves us.
Okay.
I'm thinking we might be either in the beginning of the second movement or perhaps part of the way through the first.
Okay, I'm going to work on that. Grab those headphones and I'll hit play at 8 minutes, and we'll listen to wherever we are in this Lou Harrison Symphony, a composer who really found it more important to make connections with people than to write a symphony that every orchestra would want to play. We're listening to music from the Symphony No. 3 by Lou Harrison with Andrew Kohler, who will be conducting the Kalamazoo Philharmonia's performance of it on Sunday. And that's a tiny section mm-hmm. of his third symphony. We've been trying to kind of encapsulate Harrison's view of music, which is so inclusive. This
right.
is sort of a nod to his friend and mentor, Henry Cowell, mm-hmm. who had a strong Irish affinity mm-hmm. In his music. And it just was starting to move into another dance.
Yeah, exactly. So there are three dances that comprise, so rather, again, than one single dance movement, and he gives us three. And each one is dedicated to a different person. This next one is a gentle waltz that shows the really lyrical side of Harrison. Evelyn Hinrichsen, or perhaps Heinrichsen, I've only seen it in print, I don't know exactly how she pronounced her name, was a music publisher and patroness of the arts, and he obviously had a great deal of affection for her. And this is a very tender, very, very brief, but very beautifully felt waltz. And again, you'll see that a lot of times in this symphony particularly, Harrison's concern is not necessarily with sort of density of harmony, but rather really emphasizing the melodic line. He has a very horizontal conception of music, and it is most of the time very, very tonal at this point, even though he did have a period, as I was saying earlier, where he experimented with serial music. But serial music by its nature is also kind of horizontal in conception. It's melodically driven. And so he keeps that, but instead he just sort of places so many things over a drone, for example. Again, that might come potentially partially from gamelan music. It's just so many influences all going at once, and he just finds a way, and this is the extraordinary thing, to make them all kind of work together. I really do feel like everything makes sense in this piece, even though, as I said before, it's very difficult to characterize or categorize, and maybe that's good. Maybe that's it's exactly its strength.
You said that piece was a reel, but it was colored with instrumentation so exotic that it takes it out of, you know, the sort of fiddling that
exactly.
You would expect from a reel.
It is and it isn't those things at once. Yet he is on record as commenting that he has had to tell most of the violin solos, it begins with a violin solo, that they need to play it, as he put it, quote, more country western, which is also not really a reel, but his point being that it's not intricate lacework, I think is another quote of his. It needs to be a little rougher and rowdier.
Straight ahead.
Yeah.
Let's get back into the Harrison Third Symphony, and I've backed it up a little bit. We might hear the end of the reel and the beginning of the waltz. Again, from the Third Symphony of Lou Harrison, an iconoclast American composer who's featured on the next Kalamazoo Philharmonia concert. That was a melancholy kind of waltz.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed also that not everyone in the orchestra is playing there by any means.
That's 100% the case. And he actually is very, even in the first movement, which, you know, it maybe is not so unusual to have an inner movement of a symphony have a smaller orchestration. But even in the very robust, muscular first movement, which starts with this great aggressive statement from the full orchestra, it almost immediately thins out to nothing. And he loves these extremely intimate textures. He writes frequently for just, say, one percussion instrument and maybe a single solo string instrument. You know, in that middle, we just heard what I think is one of the most unlikely and beautiful combinations of vibraphone and bassoon that he put together on the same solo, which I think is a really inspired combination. So he creates such wonderful timbres from the orchestra, and he does indeed frequently love working with just small subsets of the orchestra.
Was he able to work with orchestras as his, you know, he was off in his own category as a composer, but he found collaborations
Yeah, James. Yeah. You know, since he was a largely California-based composer through, I mean, he did live for a time in New York City, actually, but then had a nervous breakdown in 1947 and thought, I just need to get out of this place. And he did, and he never returned, and he spent the rest of his life back where he had grown up, essentially. He was born in Portland, Oregon, but then grew up in the Bay Area. And yes, I would say Michael Tilson Thomas was something of a champion of his for a while. So, as he was of many composers, and he had a decent number of performances on the San Francisco with the San Francisco Symphony. And this particular work was written for the venerable Cabrillo Festival of Contemporary Music, which has an excellent orchestra of very fine orchestral musicians from all around the country who gathered together for a couple of weeks in the summer and who have a real enthusiasm for playing new music. And this is the body that commissioned this particular work and for whom it was expressly written.
Well, it's being performed by our own Kalamazoo Philharmonia on Sunday, and it's still a rare thing to hear a full Lou Harrison symphony. How many symphonies did he eventually write?
Four, and the fourth one he titled The Last Symphony, so he was very clear that was going to be it.
I have loved his Concerto in Slendro.
Yes.
Which is a violin concerto, but it contains all of those just delicious sounds of a Balinese or Javanese gamelan orchestra.
Exactly, yep.
He wrote for many different combinations of chamber and small orchestra, solo pieces for harp. Mm-hmm. We have a few recordings. He was just so drawn to textures that help you meditate or leave this consciousness a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
Well, here in the Midwest, there was a composer, Florence Price, as you mentioned,
right?
1940s, I think, in 30s and 40s, who did collaborate or was whose work was chosen by a great American symphony, the Chicago Symphony, mm-hmm. and she was the first Black American woman, I think, to ever have a piece performed by the Chicago Symphony or a major American mm-hmm. orchestra.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. Yeah, she was born, again, in Arkansas, 1887, actually. And she had come to Chicago to sort of, with her husband, they had found some work there and she had some children. And her first symphony won a prize, a Wanamaker Prize, and that was the thing that brought it to the attention of Frederick Stock, who was then the conductor of the Chicago Symphony, and he decided to perform this piece. And that certainly got her a good amount of acclaim, and she was able to continue publishing very frequently smaller works, even though she was really interested in working in large-scale forms. But unfortunately, even though she wrote at least four symphonies, one, some of which might be lost and not sure if they were ever completed. She struggled, as one can easily imagine in that time period, to be taken seriously as a composer. So she did have some of these successes, and she was a hugely influential mentor. There was a Black Musical Association in Chicago. She ended up being the teacher to Margaret Bonds. She was sort of a mentor to Marian Anderson, the great contralto singer. So she played a wonderful role, but very often when her name is mentioned, especially for a long time after her death, when her name was mentioned, it was more in the way that you just mentioned it. That is to say, she had this first as a Black woman being performed by a major American orchestra, and less so the music itself. Why? Well, there's a letter that that she wrote to Koussevitzky, where she says so plainly that it's just heartbreaking to hear it so plainly stated. She says, she begins, there's the very first thing in the letter. She says, "My dear Mr. Koussevitzky," now she's writing him obviously to hope to convince him to program some of her works. And Koussevitzky, I should clarify, was the longtime music director of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And she said, "To begin, I have two handicaps, as she put them, those of sex and race. I am a woman and I have some Negro blood in my veins." And, you know, I mean, it is difficult to hear her kind of come face to face with the sort of prejudices that she saw, obviously, so clearly. And at the same time, it's remarkable to see what she was able to achieve by dint of her extraordinary talent, even in a time of exceptional prejudice. Now, as I say, a lot of the music was lost, and perhaps she, as a sort of kind of a footnote figure, you know, an asterisk, was perhaps that name was still heard once in a while. But something really extraordinary happened about a decade ago, and that was the thing again that I think might be going on in the performance today, later today.
Tune in at one.
Yes. and that is that some people went to this house not far from Chicago and were poking around in the attic and found just a trove of manuscripts, all of which had the name Florence Price on it. Turns out that was her summer home. And a lot of her unpublished manuscripts were rediscovered about 10 years ago. And then all of a sudden, we have this extraordinary second chance to really get to know the rather significant body of unpublished work that she wrote throughout her life, especially in these larger forms. So one of those works is called Ethiopia's Shadow in America, and that is the work that we will be performing this Sunday. I really think it's a wonderful work. I was really struck by the power and potency of its voice, and it is also, perhaps not coincidentally, a work that addresses in a very frank and head-on sort of way the Black experience in America. So Ethiopia at that time, for many African-American intellectuals, was a kind of shorthand for Africa as a whole. I sort of read up on this. Ethiopia was one of the first countries to sort of overthrow a colonial power in the late 19th century. So
it represented
exactly
Black governed
exactly
Africa.
Black governance, Black greatness, and consequently, that I think is why the title. You know, at first I thought, oh, that's interesting because, you know, many of the slaves that came to the New World were not necessarily from that part of Africa, but it became clear to me that Ethiopia was meant to be understood more broadly as the entire continent of Africa. And then it's in three movements, all of which sort of run together, and each one has bears a subtitle. The first one is called The Arrival of the Negro in the New World as a Slave. The second one is called His Resignation and Faith. And it is a really beautiful spiritual with solos for the violin and the cello. And then the last movement is entitled His Adaptation, a fusion of his native and acquired impulses.
She fulfills each one of these titles.
Yes.
It's not just poetry.
That's right. I mean, I'm certain that would have been something that would have had... That's right. It would not have been an abstraction to her, right? I mean, that's something that she was living and unknowing.
Yeah.
And like I say, you know, Florence Price had a fundamentally conservative sound for the 30s and 40s. I mean, she was in many senses someone who took to heart the suggestion of Antonín Dvořák, the great Czech composer who came in the late 19th century to America in the 1890s, and said, you know, I think that Black music, that American Indian music, that this is the folk music on which American music should be based. As you can well imagine, many composers rejected this notion, but she took it very seriously, and it is a through line in a lot of the music that she wrote, and certainly plays a role here, especially in that second movement, which is very clearly emulates a spiritual.
Well, we can start at the beginning, or we can also shuttle to somewhere in the middle, and we can keep our headphones on and see where we land.
I think starting at the beginning is great because see two sides of Florence Price here. One is there's some beautiful, again, intimate moments. There's some great use of the full orchestra. And the slow introduction of this work, which is of considerable size, is one that really kind of hints at this great cry of lament. Yeah, that's how it really begins. And then the main part of the movement is surprisingly light in character, but one thinks perhaps of, a dance, like a plantation dance or something like that, that is meant to find some modicum of joy in the grimmest of circumstances.
I'm with Andrew Kohler, and the concert is Sunday at 4 o'clock. Tickets will be available at the door or ahead of time. You can look at the Facebook page or the webpage of the Kalamazoo Philharmonia. It's called From Sea to Shining Sea. This is music of Florence Price. ¶¶ We can't get completely lost in this lovely piece by Florence Price, Ethiopia's Shadow in America, but we've just hit the section with the beautiful song to it. And if you tuned in during the music, Andrew Kohler is my guest here on Let's Hear It, and the Kalamazoo Philharmonia will feature this piece by Florence Price on Sunday. We've traversed through the introduction and a dance as well, and now we're in the sort of the soulful section here.
Yeah, this is the resignation and faith of the slaves who were brought here, and appropriately, of course, is a beautiful spiritual. It's a really powerful work, and I think one of the things that for those who are able to attend on Sunday and hear the piece in its full glory. One of the things that really strikes me about it is that cry of lament that the piece opens with when describing the slaves who were forcibly brought to the New World. The last movement, of course, is mostly focused on the slave's adaptation, fusion of the native and acquired impulses, as she puts it. And it becomes a sort of almost quite joyful dance in a way, you know, becomes sort of something like a swing dance at one point in the middle of the last movement. And then just as it gets close to the end, it sort of gets more and more frenetic. And then all of a sudden, that theme, that cry of lament, comes back really in a devastating manner. And it's in that mood that the piece ends, which I think is a very, very thought-provoking way for her to have closed that work. Anyway, it's a very powerful work, and I hope people will get a chance to hear it. These parts are so new that they were just published last August. So I don't exactly know what the performance history of this is, but there have been a few performances already, but we are likely to be one of the first to do this music, even though it was written in 1932, just unheard until really only a few years ago, undiscovered until a few years ago, left in that attic as we were talking about.
I'm sure there's a story behind tracking down all those parts that have barely been published. I mean, that's part of the work of a music director.
Sure, yeah, it is. In this case, it was actually pretty easy just because they have been published now. If we had wanted to do this a year earlier, it would have been very difficult. But like I say, the parts were just published and made public last August. So they are fresh off the press.
We've left a little bit of time to talk about the final piece on the program by Roberto Sierra, who you alluded to earlier as a professor of composition at, was it Cornell?
Cornell, that's
University.
Right, yes.
This piece, as I said, I had a chance to preview it a few months ago. It's a surprising piece in the way it integrates South American, Latin American music in a way that is so far from gimmicky that you hear this sort of internal integrity in this piece. It is not used for show.
Yeah, I think that's beautifully put. And in fact, I was reading some comments that Roberto Sierra made about this piece in particular. And what he described was a process not of transformation of the original material, but rather of transcreation, which he defined as a way that takes this music, puts it in a different context, and yet manages to keep its integrity, its sort of its soul, its message, its content is left intact. So I'm so glad that you heard that. I feel the same thing. And obviously he, as someone growing up in Puerto Rico, who describes his childhood as being sort of divided between, listening to Pablo Casals on the TV and then hearing, salsa music outside at some point, and having both of those influences kind of take equal parts of his attentions, is uniquely qualified, I think, to unify those two holes. And at the same time, I'm just struck at how brilliantly he manages to combine, the sort of compositional process of this piece. It is so intricately done. For example, for those who will be able to come on Sunday, we won't be able to listen to all of this right now, but there's, in the first movement, there's this like little phrase that just goes by in a flash of an instant. It's this jagged little phrase in the high woodwinds and the xylophone, and this spunky little theme ends up becoming the main theme of the second movement. which is a dance-like movement. And then there are these slow sections, these very meditative, dreamy, slow sections in the second movement. And those have that same theme, except it's sort of embedded into the harmony and stretched out over a long period of time. So there's these remarkably intricate correspondences between the thematic material.
You may not know it, but you might feel it.
Yes, exactly. I always feel that way. I mean, yeah. It is something that maybe even if you don't recognize it on a physical level, you still have a sense, as I think you sort of were alluding to, of great coherence in the music, that somehow, yeah, this all belongs together. Anyway, so I really have extreme admiration for his achievement, that the fact that he can balance this sort of this weighty tradition going all the way back to Beethoven and even before of the symphony, you know, capital S, and that he can kind of engage with that on his own terms and put it in a language that feels elegant to him and that makes sense to him. I think in the event, maybe we can listen to a little bit of the last movement, because it's really just so exciting and it's perhaps the most overt presence of this wonderfully massive percussion section and of those, the clave rhythm, that dum, 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 that defines so much of Afro-Cuban music and indeed is the driving force of this finale and so beautifully integrated into this brilliant symphony.
In those early rehearsals, there were so many challenges for each individual player. How does it feel now?
They're still challenging. They're still challenging, but you know, everyone is. I mean, honestly, these parts are written with exceptional virtuosity in mind. But I'm really proud of how everyone is digging in and engaging with this work, and I have a lot of hope that things are going to go really well this Sunday.
Well, thank you for championing composers like Roberto Sierra, as well as Florence Price and Lou Harrison on this concert. It's a tradition of the Kalamazoo Philharmonia, which is in its 30th season, amazingly. And it is a concert that will leave you, I think, just stunned with music you didn't know. Yeah. That's at 4 o'clock this Sunday, and we'll leave you now with the final movement of the Sinfonia No. 4 by Roberto Sierra. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Kara.